Peter Buffett is an accomplished musician and an Emmy Award-winning composer, but he's probably still best known for being the son of billionaire investor Warren Buffett. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Peter Buffett is also the author of a new book, Life is What You Make It. We'll talk with him about finding his own path in the world. Then at 10:30, Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition, will be here. He is the proud father of two little girls. I'll talk with him about becoming a father through adoption. He's written about his experience and the experiences of many others who've been touched and shaped by adoption in all of its many forms. You can also join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join us after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. My first guest today is an accomplished musician and an Emmy Award-winning composer, but when most people hear his name, it's his lineage that springs to mind. Peter Buffett is all of the things that I mentioned, and of course, he's also the son of billionaire investor Warren Buffett. He's just written a book called Life is What You Make It, Find Your Own Path to Fulfillment. And Peter Buffett is here with me today. Hello.
Hello there.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, when people hear that the son of Warren Buffett has written a book sharing some of his life wisdom that he's gained through the years,
right?
they probably think, now, why would that have anything to do with my personal experience? So why did you decide that you had something that needed to be shared?
Yeah, easy for you to say, I think, is probably the first thought on people's minds. And, you know, I really never thought about writing this book. And then in retrospect, as it came to light that my story might be valuable out there in the world, I realized that for years people had been saying, wow, you're Warren Buffett's son. You're so normal. And, you know, that was a compliment and that was kind of funny. And then it was kind of sad to think, wow, why wouldn't I be normal? And that's when I realized that, you know, maybe my story, maybe my definition of privilege or success might be valuable to tell other people how I grew up and all of, you know, how I made my own life.
Well, and there is something to that. And you write about the price of privilege for a lot of young people, the children who grew up in privilege often have problems.
Yeah, and you know, I found that the book in a lot of ways is a letter to parents because I didn't grow up that way. The privilege I grew up in was having parents that certainly loved me and respected my own decisions and said, you can do it. You can figure it out on your own. Do what you love. That's the most important thing in life. You know, don't go after money or fame or fortune. Just do what you love. Everything else will follow. You'll be much happier. And that's what I saw. I saw my dad doing what he loved every day. He was not chasing a dollar. And, you know, so privilege was very different than just having a bunch of stuff.
Well, tell me a little bit about your childhood. What was it like in the Buffett household?
Well, you know, I'm glad I'm talking in Iowa because Iowans can understand. It was very Midwestern. I grew up two blocks from where my mother grew up, so I could walk down to my grandparents' house when I was a kid. I walked to public school every day. I had the same English teacher in high school that my mother had. The house that, you know, I lived in then, my dad still lives in now. You know, he lives in the house I grew up in. I go home. I sleep in my bedroom. So there's no fence around it. You know, very classic Midwestern upbringing.
Did your parents make a conscious decision as their wealth began to grow that we want to keep our life as normal as possible for our kids?
They did. And I saw one letter my dad wrote when he was pretty young. He was probably 25. And in it, I don't remember exactly what he said, but he was clearly aware of the fact that he had a particular gift that would probably make a lot of money and that he was concerned about that in terms of raising kids in that environment. And so I think he was thinking about it very early on. And my parents luckily had extremely similar values, their value system. And, you know, so we really, again, never saw it around us. And it wasn't so much, I think, as my parents trying to keep it low key. It was just their nature, which of course makes all the difference in the world. It wasn't like they were trying to hide something. They were just being who they were. And so it was never a factor.
Did you talk about money in the family?
No, we didn't. Somebody asked me, and you might, you know, when did you realize that your dad was making all this money? And my answer to that is I think I was about 25. We just didn't see it around the house at all. Money never really came up. And it really just wasn't a factor.
As you were growing up, obviously your father was becoming more and more successful in finances.
Right.
Was there any kind of pressure or push on you to follow in his footsteps?
Only in the sense that we should do what we love. I mean, that really was the mantra. So following in his footsteps, yes, but not in the way most people would define it. It was really defined as, do what you love. Find something you're really passionate about, because that's what he did. He was so passionate about his work. It happened to make a lot of money. You know, if he was in another line of work, I think he'd be just as passionate, and it may not have the same dividends, but it didn't matter to him. He was just loving it every day, and still does at 80, by the way.
So as you were finding out what you like to do in life, did your parents try to guide you in finding what really worked for you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I loved going over to the piano from the time I could practically crawl over to it and pound on it and things. And my mother certainly recognized that as a deep interest. And so I got into piano lessons. But when I wanted to quit, and this was at the ripe old age of probably 7 when it started to get hard, you know, she didn't want to be a pushover and just say, okay, you want to quit, you can quit. But she also knew I loved the piano and she didn't want me to not like it. So she said, look, you take lessons for the next, whatever it was, 6 months or something. It seemed like a lifetime to a 7-year-old. And then she said, yeah, you can quit, because she didn't want to squelch the enthusiasm. And so in very subtle ways, she kind of pushed or allowed things to happen in a way where she knew I would kind of naturally keep going. And when I got into college, you know, I went to college because I got in, frankly. I got into Stanford, and I thought that was a great honor, so I went. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. I took everything that ended in 101 or ology, actually. And when it came time to declare a major, it was also a time when I could say, okay, maybe I should explore music. And my dad and my parents both really did support that idea to go out there and give it a try.
Well, I want to go back a little bit, though, because there was actually a moment when you considered dropping out of high school.
I did, actually. And that is a little bit of guidance that my mother, you've read the book, or at least highlights. I did think all through junior high and high school that I was going to be a photographer. That was really what I loved doing. I spent days and weeks and months in the dark room. And so I was going to finish school early and leave high school early, take summer classes and that sort of thing, and move off to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and have some romantic life as a photographer. And my mother did not want me to do that. She thought finishing school would be a good idea at the same time everybody else did. And I think she basically just sensed that I might sort of wander a little bit too much. So she, it's funny because I told this story in the book about how she and my journalism teacher got together and I ended up being the editor of the high school yearbook, which kept me in high school all the way to the end and all of that. And I felt that it was kind of happening behind my back. And after my journalism teacher read the book, he emailed me and said, no, I really did want you to be editor of the yearbook. This was not coercion, which I thought was very funny that you can correct these stories, you know, 30 years later or something.
It is interesting, though, the way that in retrospect, you perceived that story was that, and you did say in the book that your journalism teacher really did want you to be editor, but that you thought your mom had something to do with arranging it so that it would be the thing, the carrot that kept you in
right.
school for that final year. Did your parents
yeah.
ever sit down with you and say, listen, Peter, we really think you need to finish high school?
No, they really didn't, or at least certainly not that I remember. My, you know, dad to this day and certainly then, and both my parents, but my dad in particular was very much, you know, better to let you learn your lessons on your own, you know, good and bad. It's the only way they're really your own. You know, if your parents are telling you to do something and you either do it or you rebel against it, it's still in relationship to them and you don't, I don't think, get quite the same lesson as if you make the decision yourself. There's probably parents or kids out there cursing me for saying that, but I think it's really true that, you know, the lessons that are really learned are the ones that you know, again, either the mistakes you make or the advances you make based on your own decisions.
Now, when you were a child, your dad was building Berkshire Hathaway, and that was quite a job. He spent a lot of time working. How present was he in the household?
Well, it's interesting because he was not a TV dad for sure, in the sense that he was throwing around the ball in the backyard and doing all this stuff with us. But he was very present. It's an interesting thing. Again, as I got older and I heard stories of other parents and other behaviors around the house and that sort of thing, I realized that, you know, the gift my dad really gave us was consistency. He was always home at the same time. We always knew when he was walking in the garage door. And, you know, saying, I'm home, you know, and then we'd have dinner every night at the table. We knew right where he was after dinner. He'd be reading the paper in the same chair. The mood was always very consistent. He was loving what he was doing, you know, so he was a happy guy generally. And so the consistency was a phenomenal gift. So even if he wasn't, you know, doing the things on Saturday afternoon because he was at the office, because he went there, I think, 6.5 days a week, he was actually very present and very consistent. So it's an interesting sort of combination of things.
Well, I think the moment that most of us think about when people grow up with very, very wealthy parents, the stereotype, at least, is that there's a trust fund somewhere. And when you turn 18
right.
or 21, you come into a lot of money. And maybe that's one of the places where life takes a left turn for a lot of children of privilege. Your parents wanted to make sure that didn't happen to you. So what was their strategy?
Well, you know, we never expected anything. And frankly, even to this day, you know, people say, gee, you know, aren't you upset, for instance, on the philanthropy side that he gave all his money away and you're not going to get any? And I don't think I should get any. And this is a highly controversial subject among some family people, you know, people in families where they believe that the one generation works hard so the other generation can have things that didn't. And I understand that, you know, there are different relationships to hard work and passing that along, you know, the success of that to the next generation. But for me, to live off of somebody else's success just doesn't make sense. I'd rather make my own. And so that was sort of imbued in us as a family early on. And so we never really expected anything. And in fact, when I did get something at 19 from my grandfather, that was a surprise, and I realized, boy, I better make good on this one because I'm not getting anything else.
My guest today is Peter Buffett. We're talking about his new book, Life is What You Make It, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me right now is Peter Buffett. We're talking about his new book, Life is What You Make It. He is the son of billionaire investor Warren Buffett. He's also an accomplished musician and an Emmy Award-winning composer. If you'd like to join our conversation about finding your path in the world, perhaps you have an unusual story for how you discovered your true vocation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And coming up in just about 10 minutes, we'll be joined by NPR's Scott Simon. Peter, you write a lot about the basic principles, the core values that your family instilled in you and that you live by today. And one of them that I thought was most interesting, you draw a distinction between having a very strong work ethic or pursuing wealth. You think there's a difference between working hard for one reason as opposed to working hard to make money. Why do you draw that distinction?
Well, I guess because, again, you know, my dad's success is fairly unique. And so I saw it firsthand. And so many people, I think, are working hard, so they make a lot of money. And in a lot of ways, that's based on either some sort of fear, you know, that they won't have enough, or it proves something to the world that they're good enough, all these kinds of things, which speaks to a very different thing than if you're working hard because you love it. And first of all, then it's usually not work, which is also kind of nice. But, you know, I saw my dad just love it every day. And people so confuse those two things in the world. And he's such a great example of the difference, that's why I really want to call it out, because again, you know, to just work hard to make money speaks to issues that are, you know, maybe bigger than we can get into here. But living a life and doing things because you love doing them and you want to passionately work hard it makes it very different every morning when you get up, I think.
Now, of course, not everyone has that option. There are many people who have to work hard just to pay the bills.
Right.
So do you feel that that's one of the things that your upbringing gave you, was the opportunity to make a choice?
Well, there's no question that there are choices I've been able to make that maybe not everyone is able to make, for sure. And you know, it's a big world, and you know, my book may not be applicable to everyone, but there's probably a kernel of truth in it that would work for everyone, because, you know, again, it's saying in a lot of ways that the values are around family and love and connection and relationships as opposed to chasing after dollars. So even if you're working just to put food on the table, if you look at that as something less than because you're not making a ton of money, you know, because that's all you're doing, that's too bad too, because there you're providing for your family and you're creating an environment that makes your kids better off and everything else. So, you know, it kind of, you can look at it from two different directions, I guess. But, you know, there's no question in my book I say I had to make the best of a good situation. You know, I consider myself extremely lucky.
How did you find your true vocation as a musician?
Well, it was, you know, it's one of those things where usually the most obvious thing is right in front of you all the time. And again, I was playing music since I could go over and pound on, well, maybe not music, but I was pounding on the piano when I was very little. And the fact that I didn't recognize that as what I wanted to turn into a vocation is kind of the best example of, wow, it can be right in front of you. And it took me time. It took me exploring a lot of not really dead ends, but certainly a lot of avenues before, at the ripe old age of about 20, I went, oh my God, you know, this is it. It's been this way all along. And then how can I pragmatically turn that into a life, you know, writing music for commercials and that sort of thing.
Tell me about that epiphany. When did you have that realization?
Well, it was really, I had played piano again all through junior high school, that sort of thing. And I played with a guy who was really, really good. And so I just discounted my own abilities left and right and never thought I'd be much of a musician. And it wasn't until in college when a friend said, come listen to this guy play guitar. He's supposed to be pretty good. He's sitting on the floor in my dorm. And I went over there and he played so beautifully and so simply. And it really was the epiphany. It was really like, wow, music is about choosing those five notes that make people feel something. It's not about technical proficiency. I mean, you got to be decent, but it's not about that. It's about the soul of it.
Do you think everyone has a true calling?
Oh, boy, nothing like a big question. I do. I think that a lot of people mistake, like, for instance, my dad. Again, what my dad does is really very artful and very creative. Now, people would look at it and say, well, he's a businessman and he's a hard-nosed, you know, investor. But it's a passion. So I think everybody does have a passion. It may not always pay the bills. I mean, it may be that you do the thing you do during the day so you can satisfy, you know, what you really long for on the weekends or in evenings. I mean, not everything's going to turn into a vocation that puts food on the table. But I think everybody does have a passion, and it's really allowing yourself in some ways to be like I was, that 4-year-old, you know, that went right to that place that I felt so strongly about. You got to kind of reconnect to that 4-year-old.
You feel very strongly about how when people do decide what they want to do with their lives, about how they should go about doing that work. What is your philosophy on that?
Well, I mean, the big part, and it's the epilogue of the book, is commitment. I have found time and time again in my own life that if I challenge myself and commit to seeing it through, you know, showing up and not being attached to the outcome, you know, but really saying, I believe so strongly that I should be doing this and this is important to me, I'm going to commit. It's sort of phenomenal what can happen. And I'll bet there's a lot of stories out there of just that, of when you really do decide you're going to take what would be considered maybe a leap of faith, you know, that things come in that help you out, you know, and that it's really sort of magical.
I find it interesting, though, you start the book talking about your family life and about how important that was to you and in making you the person that you are. But you also write that you feel that when somebody pursues their vocation, they need to treat it as if it's the most important thing in the world. And for a lot of us who are parents, there is a shift. You know, when the children are born, all of a sudden you realize maybe work's not the most important thing in the world. So how do you balance the need to be a good father and to have a strong family with that other desire to put your work above all else?
You know, you're really asking some tough questions, because I think there's somehow a combination there, because there's no question when you have a child, you're in a different world. You know, then you're thinking about the next generation and what you can do for them. And I think you owe it actually to the child to show that focusing on your passion and what you love is a valuable part of how you can be happy in the world. So I think the best reflection, it isn't really, I mean, I suppose maybe it's enlightened self-interest, but it's not really so much self-interest as it is an example to your child that, in fact, living fully and authentically and into your passion is the best way to lead a happy life.
You also write a lot about the importance of giving back. Now, of course, you are in an extraordinary position to give
most
back.
Definitely.
Right? And
yeah.
For people who don't know, obviously your father has made a pledge to give away all of his wealth to help others. But you are also the chairman of a foundation, as are your siblings, where you have the opportunity to give to others. For people
right.
who don't are not in that position, why do you
right.
think taking time and maybe money, even if you don't have a lot, why is it so important to give?
Well, it is, again, one of those things like commitment where until you do it, you don't fully understand the feeling that it gives you and the relationship it gives you to a larger, you know, human connection and humanity and understanding the positions of others and the situations they're in. It's phenomenal when you start to kind of stretch out there and see how people live and how you can help someone in need. And also philanthropy, because, again, in the book, I point this out, it just means the love of people. It does not mean you have to have a lot of money. So, you know, the true philanthropy is giving of your time, your experience, even more valuable than money often. So that feeling, though, again, it's much like the relationship to children or family. You start to extend your family in terms of how you're feeling about helping others, and it's an extraordinary feeling.
Peter Buffett, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Peter Buffett is the author of Life is What You Make It, Find Your Own Path to Fulfillment. He'll be appearing in Des Moines this evening in a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood with a concert and conversation at 6 o'clock tonight at Drake's Cheslow Auditorium. And we'll go out here with a duet between Peter and his father.
Ain't she sweet? You're walking down the street. I ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet? Join in. Ain't.
And yes, that is Peter Buffett performing with his father, Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett on ukulele there. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And joining me now is Scott Simon. He is a Peabody Award-winning journalist, host of Weekend Edition on NPR, author of many books, and journalist of the highest caliber. A few years ago, his life changed profoundly in the best way possible. he became a dad. And becoming a parent, of course, is something that happens to a lot of us, but that doesn't make the experience less important or less profound for each one of us. Scott Simon and his wife became parents through adoption, and he's written about that experience and the experience of many others in his new book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in praise of adoption. Scott Simon, thank you so much for being here.
Good to be with you, Charity.
Well, let's talk about the big decision that you made with your wife to adopt a child. Why did you choose that path?
Well, we had tried in the, probably don't need to refer to it too euphemistically in Iowa, in the traditional manner. You know, well, yeah, you know, Charity.
Yes, I think I know what you're talking about.
And the Abraham and Sarah begetting manner, and it, you know, didn't work. And then in the 21st century, we tried a couple of rounds in the laboratory, and that didn't work. And we were at the point of deciding whether to press on with another two or three rounds in the laboratory, in which, of course, people assured us that they could come up, not assured us, but they said the odds were good, we could come up with some result. And my wife and I just looked across this field of figures we'd sketched out on an envelope and said, wait a minute, we even when we were courting, my wife and I were, as I think you might know, Charity, married after a week. But in that week of intense conversation, we had talked about adopting at some point in our lives. And we said, wait a minute, there are children out there in the world, in this country and overseas, who are alive right now, who are crying out for the love of a family. And we could sure use their love. Why don't we adopt?
When you made that decision to adopt, what happened next? There are so many different pathways you can take to adoption. How did you narrow down your choices?
Well, you know, inevitably we went to workshops. Inevitably we went on the web and read about what some of our options and choices were. I think the workshops were particularly valuable because we met other people who were on the verge of the same kind of decision. And we actually enjoyed all the workshops. And I think we... You know, there's some practical, enormous practical determinations to make, and one of the first ones is what programs are you eligible for? I was already over 40. My wife still isn't. I underscore that. But it was my age more than hers that drove up our cumulative age and, you know, put us, would have put us at the back of the line for most domestic programs. We might have adopted from a domestic foster care system, but that would have been an older child, and we'd never been parents before and didn't feel that we were really equipped to begin with an older child. And that's when we began to look overseas, and then every different country that we investigated would have some kind of stipulation. And I'm afraid at that particular time, for a lot of reasons, which are not at all edifying, the Chinese program was the most reliable, stable, seemed to be, we hadn't heard any stories about epical corruption. I'm from Chicago, as you know, and I have no problem with putting a little cash in an envelope to help things along. But what we'd heard about some other programs is that you would get over there to a country and they would say, you know, that child whose picture we sent you, you were supposed to, well, you know, something's happened. Come back in another couple months, we'll have another child for you. And we'd been through a lot just trying to have a family, and I just thought that was emotionally devastating. And at the time we applied, we were told the wait after you're approved for adoptions from China was 9 months. Turned out to be 18 months. And for our second daughter, it was 2 years. But it just seemed the most reliable program going.
When you attended those workshops, you wrote a little bit about this and discovering quickly some of the wrong reasons to adopt. What did you learn at those workshops about why people shouldn't be there?
Well, I would say the first one is that they often say, look, we've all heard the stories about the couple that fills out the paperwork and they even get approved to adopt, and then they find out that they're pregnant. And there seems to be this urban myth that's taken hold that all you have to do is apply to adopt and you'll get pregnant. And the people who ran the workshop said, look, there is no correlation whatsoever between filling out the paperwork for adoption and getting pregnant. That's not how you get pregnant. We've all heard those stories, and that's accidental. So if you're here because you don't really want to adopt, but thinking that going through the motions will make you pregnant somehow, don't do it. Because that's, you know, we need people here who only want to adopt. And that was a big one.
And did people leave?
Yeah, after, you know, they have the inevitable break for coffee and cookies, and yes, a couple of people had left at that point.
You also write about how you feel that adopting because you want to save a child or rescue a child from a terrible fate, you don't think that that's a good reason or the right reason to adopt.
No, I don't. And I mean, you know, maybe if a child is personally known to you in that kind of circumstance, and oh, you know, we can't let him or her go to an institution, so we'll adopt. But I think no. You know, having the impulses of a social worker, and we met with a lot of social workers, and God bless the work they do, but I think that's not necessarily a healthy motive for a parent. I think you want to adopt because you want children. And, you know, having children reminds you that in the end we are all wild animals, you know, and they don't stay fixed. They all, you know, they all develop according to their own rate and their own interests. So I think adopting to do something good is not a helpful motive for a parent. You want to adopt because you want to be a parent, because you crave the love that a child can give you, and you can give that child love.
My guest is Scott Simon, NPR's host of Weekend Edition and author of many books. His most recent book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in praise of adoption. He's written about his journey to becoming a father and also the adoption stories of many other people, both people who were adopted or adopted children into their lives. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Scott Simon is my guest, and we'll be continuing our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm here today with Scott Simon, the host of Weekend Edition on NPR, the author of many books, and also most recently the author of Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in praise of adoption. He'll also be appearing as part of Iowa Public Radio's Insight series in Des Moines on September 28th. You can find out more about the series on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And you can join our conversation today, 866-780-9100. Is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Scott, for those of us who became parents in the traditional way, becoming a parent is a pretty sudden experience. Although you have 9 months or so to build up to it, the act of giving birth and actually holding that child for the first time is the most profound experience. And I know that for people who adopt, people report having many different kinds of experiences with how long it took for them to bond with the child and fall in love with that child and feel like they were that child's parent. What was your experience with your first daughter that you adopted?
Oh, I think the feeling only deepens, but I made that connection from the moment we got her picture. You get this little thumbnail-sized portrait that I still carry around in my wallet, my card case, of this little girl who was then 4 months old. She was 11 months old by the time we got her in our arms, and there was just something in her little eyes and her tiny tender shoulders, and knowing that she was ours. I used to hold the picture up to my lips on airplanes, just whisper to her, "We're coming, baby." I felt that more or less immediately, but your feelings do deepen. They mature as you go along. She, you know, being put into our arms was not the highlight of her young life at that point, at the age of 11 months. She was crying inconsolably because, you know, we were funny looking, smelled funny. As you know, Charity, I am kind of goofy. And I'm sure they told her she was going to be adopted by top drawer people, and there I am. But, you know, that only lasted 2 or 3 days. My wife and I held her, put her between us, kissed her, held her, all that sort of stuff she hadn't been receiving in the orphanage. We would get outside of her crib, and we would cheer for her to let her know that we were on her side. We would chant her Chinese name, which is now her middle name, but we would chant, "Feng Xiao Mei, Feng Xiao Mei, Feng Xiao Mei." And really within 2 days, I believe being 11 months old, she had decided, well, you know, this is my best ticket in life at the moment, these two guys. And she really had really began to make that fundamental connection with us. It really happened astonishingly quickly.
Now, in retrospect, that sounds very fast. When you say it was only 2 days,
oh, but in the middle of it, you would look at each other.
How did that feel when you had this child you were trying to console and you couldn't?
My wife and I looked at each other and said, "What have we done? This child doesn't want us. Who are we kidding?" And I think we had fundamentally misread in a peculiar way our own importance in her life at that point. We were recent arrivals. She had experienced something else. But, you know, may I liken that, not having obviously any personal experience of it, of childbirth? I mean, who was it who observed many years ago? It was either George Bernard Shaw or gosh knows who said that, you know, if the pain of childbirth, if we remembered it too keenly, nobody would ever have children. And this at a very minor level is, I think, the same in adoptions that way. This was just a couple of days out of our life. May I follow up on something we said before the break, Charity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were talking about what I considered that you shouldn't want to adopt because you wanted to do something good. It was during the break that I realized probably what I should have said. You should adopt because it's joy, not duty. And I think you'll be a good parent if being a parent is joyful for you, not a sense of duty.
Your girls are both adopted from China, and of course most of us know about the situation in China, the one-child policy, and the fact that sons are so much more highly valued in China, and that has led to this situation where there are lots of baby girls who are abandoned and then put up for adoption, and many of them are coming to the United States as part of very happy families, people who are very relieved to be able to welcome a child into their home. And of course, you set out on a path to get these girls into your life. So in a way, that must make them feel very loved that you went to this effort. But do you have a fear that as they get older, they will ask questions about, why didn't my birth mother want me?
Oh, Elise has already asked that question. Elise is our 7-year-old a number of times. You know, and no, not a fear. I mean, I know those questions and more like them will happen and grow even sharper. They're bright young kids, and these are the most fundamental questions as to how they came about in the world what they mean in our lives. And we handle them as best we can. Of course, we have astonishingly little information. We know where the Chinese government says they were found and what their birthday is. I don't know. Do we even trust in that? I think we treat it as being real. But I don't view that as the basis for a trauma or a problem so much as it as now I view it as an opportunity to have a conversation that helps them grow up and mature and become real human beings on their own. I don't think there's any reason to be frightened of the answers. My wife and I have great, persisting admiration for the scared young women in China who might well have been illegal for them to bear them. It was certainly illegal for them to not keep them, to relinquish them. And I think it's hard for us, in living in the comfort of the West, to relative comfort of the West, to understand how brave, what kind of bravery it takes for a young woman in China to bring a child to term and bring her into the world when it might well be against the law, and yet that's what they choose to do. So we have a world of admiration for their young mothers, and I hope in a decent world and more decent China one day we can thank them.
There are many people who would spin that story in a different way, that would feel a lot more negative about these women who maybe gave up a daughter in hopes of having a son or something along those lines.
Well, I mean, there's a good chance that might have well happened, yes, absolutely.
But have you, for the sake of your girls, have you made an effort to come to terms with the actions of their birth mothers and find that love for them too?
I guess we choose the kinder interpretation, absolutely. But you know, you have to understand the young women in China are living in a tyranny. There are very severe penalties. I mean, is it attractive? Is it laudable in our Western sense of things to give up a little girl because you hope to get a boy because a boy can be more helpful, you think, financially? no, is the way we understand that that's not. But I think as they have to understand life in an area which is tough and grim and uncompromising and unforgiving, I certainly think I do understand it. And I think, and one thing too, and I you know, it's maybe inauthentic for me to tell people what I think are really important feminist principles. You have to understand, for a young woman in China, the right to choose means something different. The right to choose for them is the right to choose to have their child. This was perhaps a young mother who could have, knowing that perhaps she was about to give birth to a girl, she could have interrupted the pregnancy. That obviously is not a problem in China, but she chose not to do that and chose to put their child, to whom they gave birth, in a place where she could be discovered and where she hoped they would be able to have a better life. And that's why my wife and I are filled with admiration for what they did.
In your book, you have written about the adoption stories of many people, both from the perspective of parents who chose to adopt and from the perspective of people who were adopted into a family as children. What were you hoping to find when you started collecting these stories? What kind of thread were you looking for?
I don't know as I was looking for a thread, except, if I may, the thread of love that binds us all together. I mean, I think of this as in the end, a book of love stories about how people find each other and fall in love. In this case, it happens to be our children. Or I tell the stories of some grown-up children and their parents. I do think of it as a series of romances. My wife and I have only been parents for 6.5 years, so we freely recognize that we're still in the rapture stage. So we took advantage of the opportunity to talk to people like Steve Levitt, the Freakonomics professor. He and his wife have 2 adopted children. Frank DeFord, he and his wife Carol have a child, Scarlett, now grown and a jewelry designer here in New York, doing very well. And oh my gosh, Jeff Seller, the Broadway producer who grew up an adopted youngster in suburban Detroit, he and his partner Josh now have 2 kids. Alexander Julian, the great fashion designer who discovered when he was 60 that there was a son he didn't know he had and who was adopted, and the relationship between all of their families blending together. I found these all very compelling stories, and we were able to learn from each and every one a little something that I hope in the end will make my wife and I better parents and maybe even better people.
I want to return to the story of the Broadway producer who, as you mentioned, he was adopted as a child.
Yeah, Jeff Seller. Yes.
Jeff Seller. And then
West Side Story, Rent,
Avenue Q,
yes.
And he also now is an adoptive father as well. And that's such an interesting story because he didn't necessarily have the most romantic or the best of adoption stories. He was his birth mother and father weren't prepared for a fourth child. He would have been the fourth child in their family and just chose to give him up for adoption. He was adopted by another family. He was their second child. Their first child was a natural or biological, pardon me, child. And that family had a lot of problems.
Yes, it was bad times for the family. They were in financial decline, and Jeff, living in a suburb of Detroit, always grew up on the literal other side of the tracks. Jeff's perceptions are very wise. He says, interestingly, that his sister still feels as if his parents shine more attention on Jeff, because he was a friendly little fair-haired kid that smiled. And he says, you know, Jeff is a man of the theater, so he says kids that smile get smiles back. His sister, the biological child of his parents, was not one of those kids, and she didn't feel as rewarded or recognized. So he and his partner, Josh, who have two youngsters, I think have been as scrupulous as any parent really scrupulous, but they have certainly been aware of the fact that it's important to engage with your child and have that kind of fundamental cord of joy that ties the two of you together. And I think he and, it's very funny. Josh, his partner, says, you're always seeking attention, you're self-involved, you always have to be the life of the party. That undoubtedly traces back to the fact that you're adopted. And Jeff says, and you're, you know, you're always looking to kind of light up a room, and you're like the puppy that wants to be adopted and go home from the pet store. And Jeff says, hey, I'm in the theater. Everybody here is like that.
Adopted or not.
Exactly. I just happen to be the one that's adopted. And he says something, one of my favorite sort of, that I find quoting a lot in the book, and gosh knows, might, you know, might one day quote to even our daughters, because he addresses the fact that, you know, it's very easy to kind of trace any problem you have, to trace it back to the fact that you were adopted. No, well, I feel this way because I'm adopted, and it does that to my self-esteem or that self-worth, all that sort of thing. And Jeff says, look, if you want to make that the one problem in your life that you never get over, you can do that. You just won't have much of a life.
Right.
And he says that, you know, the fact is growing up is a series of sometimes disappointments and frustrations and losing things, but learning from our losses, learning from our sadnesses, getting up and going on and getting stronger and better in life. And I think that's absolutely true. And it's something that at one point my wife said to our oldest daughter, Elise, she said something like, you know, look, darling, everything that's different about you now is going to turn out to be an asset. Everything that you notice now might make you feel a little bit different in the end is going to be a real blessing, and it'll make you stronger, and you will be strong. And boy, I believe that about our girls.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to mention another story that you told, and that was for Jack and Pat Kiernan, who I believe adopted four children.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
through the foster care system, these were kids that really did need help, and they welcomed them into their home. And not all of those kids have had absolutely happy endings. And I think that's a really interesting story that you chose to tell, because it shows that, you know, many of us want to believe with our whole hearts that if we love a child and care for a child, we can fix whatever is wrong.
Yeah.
And we can't.
Well, that's true. And you know, Thomas Lauderdale, head of the group Pink Martini, is considered a wonderful example of what happens when you love a child who's adopted. He was adopted at a very early age. And, of course, he's went to Harvard, musical genius, famous all over the world for his music. His other siblings are adopted. One of them had an involvement with drugs, went into a tailspin, and died at a very early age. As his father, Kirby Lauderdale, said to me, my wife and I have told ourselves we probably don't deserve half the praise we got for what Thomas did with his life, and we probably don't deserve half the blame that we've heaped on ourselves for what happened to his sister. But, you know, I don't like these things scored on a scorecard like successful or failed adoption. The fact is the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, and the Bushes all have their stories too, don't they? And nobody traces that back to the effect of adoption or, you know,
right,
biblical birth in the traditional manner. I just think the ratio is probably about the same. So there aren't successes and failures. It's just life.
What do you hope that people will take away from this book?
First and last, I hope it's a good read, because they are a series of, I think, wonderful portraits and insights into family stories that often just are not told publicly, and people really open their lives. And it's a series of love stories and romances. I do hope, I don't mind saying this, that for some people, this opens a door to adoption if they hadn't considered it before. Opens a door to adoption in the sense of maybe understanding life a little bit more differently and getting less hung up about things like blood and genes and ethnic identity and understanding the central things that tie us together. But I also think practically, if people are considering adding to their family, I hope this opens a door to adoption, because that's one of the great unfinished endeavors of the world.
Scott Simon, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Charity.
Scott Simon is the author of many books, but including Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in praise of adoption. He'll be appearing as part of Iowa Public Radio's Insight series. You can find out more about the series at iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.